Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Plotzer coming at you live from somewhere in Maryland, 15, 20 miles outside Baltimore. And we just spent a beautiful Shabbos in New York, a wedding in Lakewood. And now we're on our way to Baltimore and then out going out west to come back home to Cincinnati. Welcome to Book Club Class. We're reading Wisdom from the House of Healing, Transformative Encounters of a Hospital Chaplain. We're right outside of 7-Eleven. Let's do a truncated class. I got to get to the Mincha at the Aguda. We got to eat something, and then we have a long slog ahead of us out west to Cincinnati. We have all kinds of reasons to get back in at a normal hour. So it's going to be a shortened class, but still you'll get something out of it, hopefully. We're on page 214, and here we go. What We Don't See, God. One of the most fascinating biblical books is Esther. Read on the Jewish holiday of Purim, it tells of how the Jewish people were saved from a decree of annihilation declared against them by the Persians. The book is unique in that it is a part of the biblical canon, but does not mention God's name. A simple reading can easily lead one to conclude that salvation was due to the intervention of Esther and Mordechai, and that God had no role whatsoever. Jewish tradition, however, rejects such an interpretation, insisting that even when God seems to be absent from the events of the nation, or even of the individual, He is simply in hiding, but not absent. We may not see his presence at the time, but in retrospect, we understand he was orchestrating the events. I recently heard a story about Rabbi Michael Levy, an acquaintance from my college years, which beautifully expresses this point. Quote, as all children reach a certain age when they can walk to school on their own, Michael was no different, except Michael was blind. At age 10, he pushed for a mobility instructor to teach him how to safely and confidently navigate the walk. After much training, it was determined that he could now make the walk on his own. The special day came, and he arrived to school without incident. As he approached the entrance of the playground, a friend of his shouted, "Good morning, Michael Levy." He followed this warm hello with, "And good morning, Mrs. Levy," who sped by closely behind Michael on her bike. Although he could never see his mother, Michael recognized that she was always there for him, and she needed to be, at that time and throughout his life. Moreover, he emphasized how difficult it must have been for her to let go of him as he embarked on this and other new challenges. Still, she tried her best to not reveal the occasions she was watching him or the anxiety it brought her. Imagine then how God must watch over each of us. We too may often feel that God is absent from our lives, only to be awakened to the fact that he was actually there all along, hiding, watching, even guiding and leading us to where we are today and to who we have become. But to do this, he too must let go and allow us to go forward on our own. And like a loving parent, he must agonize at watching his children make all manner of mistakes, often when they have not sufficiently internalized the training he sought for them to navigate life's journey. Page 216, What We Don't See, the Soul. I once heard a story about a forensic pathologist who argued with everyone he met that there was no such thing as a soul, a neshama. As evidence, he utilized his own personal experience. He pointed out that he had gone through thousands of bodies in his career, and he had never seen a soul. A brain surgeon was once on the other end of the discussion, and he responded back to the pathologist, "You know, I have gone through thousands of brains in my career, and yet I have never seen a thought. Does that mean there are no thoughts? Just because we don't see something does not mean it doesn't exist." Rabbi Balk thinks this came from Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky. Indeed, the soul is the breath of life that God blew into man at the moment of his creation. The word for soul in Hebrew, neshama, comes from the Hebrew linshom, to breathe. Just as God has no physicality that allows his existence to be proven, despite the efforts of philosophers throughout history to offer rational proofs, so too, that which was breathed into us from God cannot be proven to exist. Of course, not all things that exist can be proven to exist. Love cannot be proven to exist, but the spiritual components of God and the soul The intimate relationship we have with another person may also be ineffable, too great to describe in words. I once had a philosophy professor, Dr. Neil Gilman, who said that when he was younger, he had gone out on some dates with a young lady, and at some point, he returned to report to his roommate that he was in love. His roommate asked him how he knew that to be true. He answered that whenever he takes this woman out, they have a great evening with each other. His roommate responded that the two of them go out and have great times regularly. And it does not mean that they're in love. The roommate says, we go out, you and me, we as roommates go out with each other. We have great times regularly. And that doesn't mean that we're in love. So Dr. Gilman explained that they had bought meaningful gifts for each other that reflected that they were in love. The roommate responded that there are couples who may buy all sorts of gifts for each other, for their birthdays, for their anniversary, and for other occasions. But such gifts will not indicate this is a loving couple if such expressions of kindness do not accompany their relationship year-round. Dr. Gilman explained that there was also a physical attraction and physical activity that reflected their love. His roommate once again pointed out that such physical activity can happen in all sorts of places, but often has nothing to do with love. The attempts to prove his case continued, with his roommate shooting down each effort, until my teacher finally concluded, I guess you're right. I can't say that I'm in love. The truth be told, professor concluded years later, love is not something easily proven or put into words. One may indeed be in love, even if he cannot fully explain it. And if I may add, if anything is unexplainable and incomprehensible, it is often the sincere love we see among couples, of which we have no understanding whatsoever of what one of them sees in the other, or how with so many differences they could possibly stay together. It's been said that those things we cannot see, those things, the existence of which we cannot prove, like God, the soul, and love, are the things we should consider the most real and the most meaningful. It is, in fact, such elements, as a result of their spiritual nature, that last forever. And wasn't that the answer of the Herald Tribune newspaper to Virginia? She wanted to know if there was such a thing as Santa Claus, because her friend said that there wasn't such a thing. So the newspaper said, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. Read that. That is a very fitting button to put on this beautiful chapter. Read that essay by the Herald Tribune, the New York Herald Tribune, probably in the 1920s or 30s, to a little girl named Virginia O'Hanlon, I think, or Virginia. I don't know where she's from. Her name was Virginia O'Hanlon. And read that. Google it. It says, you know, the title is, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. A most beautiful, beautiful essay. Trust me, it's beautiful. Page 219. Not just God, my God. For a religious person who believes in God, it's not sufficient that he believes in a God who is all-powerful and governs the universe. That God must be a personal God, a God who relates to me and to my life, as well as to the lives of others. The degree to which this connection goes is expressed in a commentary that a rabbi offered upon the opening morning prayer in the Jewish prayer book, which is the same prayer before one retires at night. That prayer, Adon Olam, Master of the Universe, begins with a portrayal of God as the King, the Creator, the Eternal, the Glorious, the Almighty. But then, after describing God in the most magnificent and lofty manner possible, presents a phrase which in all likelihood is taken for granted, but which in truth is one of the most astounding theological phrases that could ever be said. He is my God. Who Kaylee? He is my God. The God of the entire universe is mine? I have a personal relationship with this unfathomable God? I can connect to the seemingly unapproachable God? Indeed, I can. In fact, one of the Hebrew words for God is mentioned constantly in the biblical text, as well as endless times throughout Jewish prayer. Ah, and then, Donai, which means my master. In this case, with the emphasis on the word my. Thus, every time this word for God is articulated, it should alert the person who says it that this great God is my personal God. I can pray to him. I can speak to him. I can put my burdens upon him. A God who does not relate to his creatures is hardly a God worth worshiping. It is precisely because I can utter this incredible phrase, He is my God, that I can find meaning in the life which He has granted me. True beauty. A nurse with whom I established a close relationship as a regular visitor to her father, who was on the oncology floor until he passed away, had now asked me to visit her sister-in-law, who had also been ravaged by the disease and was facing death. As I entered the room, I was not prepared for what I would see. The woman before me, who was about 50, was completely bald as a result of her cancer treatments. Her body was not much more than that of a skeleton. As I approached, she spoke in a voice as high as any I had ever heard, like an angel, due to its otherworldly character, would be the best way I could describe it. A light seemed to radiate from her face. I found myself to be in a fully spiritual mode with no concern whatsoever for the physical. How else could I explain that when I glanced upon this sickly woman, I said to myself, this is a beauty I have never seen before. Indeed, this statement was confirmed after I prayed with her. As I prayed, I became tearful. When I finished, I sadly said to the patient, I am so sorry you have to be in this bed, in this condition, suffering so terribly. I am so sorry. There is nothing that doctors can do for you, and nothing that I can do for you. I then remained silent for a long while, deep in reflection upon the type of world God had created, which could allow for such suffering. And then, in her high-pitched angelic voice, she said, Don't worry, Rabbi. It's okay. Everything is going to be fine. Really, God is bigger than cancer. I am going to be with God. You don't have to be sad for me. Now that had to come from an angel. No, not an angel, but even higher, even higher. She thanked me profusely for coming to be with her. But of course, I recognized that what she had shared with me was far greater than what I had shared with her. I cannot imagine the reward this woman received when she met her maker a few weeks later. I cannot forget what she looked like and what she said to me. This was indeed true beauty I had experienced, beauty of the spirit that overwhelmed the ugliness of a disease that could not defeat her pure soul. We live in a world that judges who is beautiful so superficially. If only we could all sense beauty in the true way God allowed me to sense it on that day, how different the world would be. God's kiss. And this ends off the chapter. And we'll end our class today with this essay, God's Kiss. One who follows his unique path and fully attempts to reach his divinely directed destination will, at the end of his days, experience joy and fulfillment that testifies to the nobility of his effort. A piece from Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch on his commentary to Psalm 90, quote, All the happiness that man is capable of attaining lies in the certainty that he has lived all his years, days, hours, and minutes on earth in loyalty to God, and that he has faithfully done his duty throughout that time. He who knows how to utilize every moment of his existence for the faithful service of God will find the true purpose of his life in every moment that he spends on earth. And whenever God sees fit to call him away, he will heed the summons, serene in the thought that he has happily reached the goal for which he was created. I once had an interaction with a patient who appeared to identify a great deal with the above sentiment. Prior to my arrival, I asked the nurse for some background about the patient's condition. She informed me that the patient was 80 years old and the patriarch of a large family. He just recently had heart surgery that was unsuccessful. He was being kept alive by a heart pump, and doctors had discussed trying the surgery again, but feared he may die on the operating table. The patient had now decided, with the full support of his family, to be removed from this device and expire. When I entered the room to see the patient, it was absolutely packed with loved ones to such a degree that I could not even get a glimpse of him. Everyone had to make a path just so I could get through. It was obvious to me that these were the adult children of the patient who were present, along with many grandchildren, siblings, and his wife. They greeted and introduced themselves to me as I entered. As I finally reached the patient, I was shocked to see who was before me. I had expected to see an older man, weak, on his back, with a mask and all sorts of tubes attached to his body, a man who could either not speak at all or only do so with great effort. Lo and behold, I saw what appeared to be a vibrant younger man, in the prime of his life, with searing blue eyes and a handsome face, who was sitting up in bed and actively engaged in lively conversation with his family. I wondered if I was in the right room. After introducing myself to the patient, I told everyone I had forgotten my book of prayers, and I would be back in a minute. I then approached the nurse and asked her if I had the correct patient. This man looks better than almost anyone I know. And he wants to pull the plug? The nurse assured me things were not as they seemed. On the inside, the patient was far worse. He had been on high doses of morphine, was exhausted from the use of the heart pump, had little chance of survival beyond a few weeks, and would gradually deteriorate in body function during that time. I returned to the room, and the conversation with the patient continued from where it left off. The patient. Have you met the members of my family, Chaplain? I'm so proud of all of them, and they have been good to me. Yes, I met them when I entered the room. That is such a blessing, but I understand you feel the time has come for you to leave them. Yes, Chaplain, I am tired, and have had enough. I have enjoyed a wonderful life, and I am at complete peace with myself. I am not going to be a burden upon my family, and so I have decided to remove myself from the machine. We discussed this as a family, and we are on the same page. My life has been a good one. I have had opportunities to do a great deal of good for a lot of people, and I have no regrets. Okay, I can see you have thought this out. By the way, what is your religious faith? Oh, I'm a Catholic, but I don't belong to a particular church. Well, would you rather have a priest? We have one on our staff. Oh, no, Chaplain. I am sure you can get me to the same place that he can. When the patient said that last line, I was temporarily speechless, and I experienced a great spiritual moment. Not only was I not a priest, I had just met the man. Still, he was so open to my presence. I read Psalm 23 to the patient and emphasized that I had seldom seen a person who absolutely believed in its words, that the Almighty truly was his shepherd, that he would be brought to a place of peace, that with death at the door, he had no fear, and that grateful as he was for the wonderful life he had been granted, together with a loving family, he now genuinely wished to simply dwell in the house of God forever. I closed by asking that God welcome this precious soul to his abode and give strength to the family to carry on in the ways of their loved one. The patients and family thanked me, and I left the room. The nurse told me the next day that the heart pump had been turned off shortly after I'd gone. She also informed me that she was present when the patient told the family he did not want a formal funeral or any obituaries written about his passing. He maintained that all the people who were close to him were in the room at that moment, and he had no need for anyone else to attend. This decision, I was further informed, was actually very comforting to the family, who saw in it an expression of intimacy that had characterized the relationship with the patient throughout their lives. While death is often ugly, horrifying, and overwhelming, it is possible for even that experience, amidst the proper circumstances and setting, to be dignified, spiritual, and even beautiful. This patient, with his sense of accomplishment and familial love, was certainly an example of such a death. The Talmud has described leaving this world in such situations as no more traumatic than taking a hair from a cup of milk, or as one rabbi put it, simply moving from one room to another. That's the Kutzker. He was said to have added, the wise man, however, makes every effort to ensure that he receives a nicer room than the one he currently occupies. That's the Kutzker. Even beyond these metaphors, we end off. Jewish tradition teaches that certain great individuals, if Moses is the primary example, are said to die by receiving a kiss from the Almighty, because his death is described as by the mouth of God in Deuteronomy 34. For the individual who has lived a life of complete commitment to the fulfillment of his purpose, death does not need to be the terrible end so often portrayed. For the righteous, it can be painless and, in rare instances, to be sure, even pleasurable. I want to thank everybody for calling in today. I want to thank you for joining me. That'll be today's class. God willing, next week we'll get back together again, close to finishing the book. Next week, it'll be chapter 10, Why Jews Don't Do Jesus. So thank you so much, everybody. Wishing everybody a great day. Join us tomorrow night. It's off Tuesday. I hope to be there live and in person at the shul at 7:30 for Isaiah. Please join me then. Everybody have a great rest of the day. If you're traveling, safe travels to you. Take care and be well. Have a great one. Shul Plotzker signing off now for Gulf Planet Synagogue and the School of Jewish Studies. Thank you, Jake and Mitch, for all you do to publicize our shiurim on shiurimgerman.com. Take care and be well. Bye-bye now.